The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Today on the Town Hall Review, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy, our nation is gripped by terror, then shock and grief as we closed in on Election Day 2018.
Our nation mourns the loss of these extraordinary Americans, and we also pray for those who were wounded. Our hearts are with the four brave police officers who were shot and injured while trying to stop the attack. The president cherishes the American Jewish community for everything it stands for.
This ugly, hateful destruction of human life in Pittsburgh is immediately and predictably politicized by liberal media. Michael Medved clarifies the record.
It's not an October surprise. It's a hideous crime. Grieving is not just a Jewish or conservative or liberal or Christian. It is national.
Entering the final week of campaigning for Congress, assurances from Democrats predicting a House blowout, well, they are fading.
You know, the House is really a toss-up. I think it's one of those things where it's very, very difficult to predict exactly what the margin's going to be. But I think Republicans are going to be competitive coming into the stretch run here on the House side. But the Senate does look very good.
And this time, California House races may be determinative. We'll hear from Pepperdine's Pete Peterson.
In these toss-up races, a few Republican wins could spell a difference.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern and on demand 24/7. Learn more at hughhewitt.com. The vast energy surrounding the approaching November election was quieted abruptly by a reality check from two incidents. First, the pipe bombers targeting of high-profile leaders on the left. No sooner was Cesar Sayoc apprehended as the prime suspect did the attention of the nation jolt towards an even more horrific crime. It was the most lethal attack on Jews in our nation's history. Pittsburgh's Tree of Life Synagogue congregation lost 11 worshipers as shooter Robert Bauer's hatred translated into unspeakable violence. My Salem colleague Michael Medved, an Orthodox Jew, was put off by the haste with which the incident turned political.
The perspective here, it seems to me, should go well beyond who gains from this, quote, October surprise. It's not an October surprise. It's a hideous crime. Grieving is not just a Jewish or conservative or liberal or Christian. It is national. And Andrea Mitchell over at MSNBC was on with Lou Weiss. He's the father of Wall Street Journal and New York Times columnist Barry Weiss. And she asked him a provocative and very slanted question.
This is a really hard thing to talk about, and I know it's controversial. But it's not just our political leaders, because we see thousands of people at rallies starting in 2016 and straight through to this weekend, who are cheering hateful speech. Who are we as Americans?
And here is the answer from Lou Weiss.
It's a good point, but on the other hand, I really can't think of anything less helpful than to be politicizing this. I think we need to step back from that and stop trying to politicize every aspect of this. I mean, this man hated Jews. He actually hated Trump. As it happens,
you can charge Trump with lots and lots of stuff. It is unequivocal that Donald Trump cares deeply about the state of Israel. He adores his Jewish grandchildren. And it's the worst kind of political smear, and it's totally unfair. Here was the opening statement at the White House press briefing from Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
Our nation mourns the loss of these extraordinary Americans, and we also pray for those who were wounded. Our hearts are with the four brave police officers who were shot and injured while trying to stop the attack. We thank God for these officers and for every member of law enforcement who responded swiftly and bravely. The president cherishes the American Jewish community for everything it stands for.
By the way, some props to the NFL. The Pittsburgh Steelers went on with their game, and that was the right thing to do. And yeah, there were some religious Jewish people in the crowd. USA Today wrote about them. And there was a sign that I think caught the attention of many people, which is hatred can't break a city of steel.
Meanwhile, this country is a virtual polling machine and media is rife with prediction. But recently, there's been a marked turn in the direction of numerous congressional races. I discussed this with my friend and Salem colleague, Lonnie Chen, a fellow at the Hoover Institution and one of the best political analysts. Lonnie should be a participant in my midterm madness contest. That's my contest for predictions on the tight race in the cycle. Lonnie, I look at the numbers and I'm very, very, very optimistic about the Republicans in the Senate. And I'm not resigned to losing the House as I was a month ago. What say you?
Hugh, I'm in the exact same place as you are. I think Republicans look very, very good in the Senate fight. This is something that we always thought would happen as we got closer to the race, that some of these races would settle out, and I think we're seeing that for sure. You know, the House is really a toss-up. I think it's one of those things where it's very, very difficult to predict exactly what the margin's going to be. But I think Republicans are going to be competitive coming into the stretch run here on the House side. But the Senate does look very good, no question about it.
I do not believe Arizona is going to vote for a radical, and you know Arizona pretty well. What do you think?
Right. So I think there's a few factors here, Hugh. First of all, absolutely, the data I've seen as well from Arizona suggests that the early vote has come in ahead of pace for Republicans. The second point is just the fact that, Kyrsten Sinema, I mean, not only is this someone who has seen fit to criticize Arizona and Arizonans, but someone whose record is really from the far left. And I think when people really sit down and they think about what the choices are, I tend to think that even the late-breaking voters will settle in favor of Martha McSally.
Let me talk to you, though, about the meta thing that's going on here. Democrats were panicked a week ago because the Kavanaugh effect is real. And by the way, it continues to be real. Along comes the crazy bomber. David French calls him a super fan. I call him a deranged psychopath. And then comes the neo-Nazi Trump-hating massacre of Pittsburgh Jews. I think Democrats are hoping that the jar to the country will somehow jar the election. And Catherine Rampell writes in the Washington Post today, this is almost astonishing to me, the White House says it's unfair to blame President Trump for our poisonous, increasingly violent political atmosphere. And you know what? They're right. Trump isn't to blame. His entire party is, because it never had the reckoning it needed after the 2016 election. Now, I believe she's sincere, and I believe most of elite media believes that. But I think that absolutely is repulsive to the ordinary American. What do you think, Lonnie Chen?
Yeah, I not only is it repulsive, but it just defies reason. This notion that somehow, because you've got Republicans that have tried to work together with President Trump in advancing an agenda for the American people, that somehow they bear responsibility for what is clearly fundamentally the responsibility of a deranged man who sent pipe bombs through the U.S. mail, and a person filled with hatred who committed, in my mind, an unforgivable act. And so, this is part of the media narrative. You get it. You understand it. At some point, it was always going to get here. How is it that folks in the media are going to figure out a way to try and blame Republicans to turn the election? And I think you're seeing that. Now, the question is whether it's going to work or not. And I'm not sure that it will. I mean, I see the narrative out there. I see a lot of people trying to make this case. But I just don't see it. I think at the end of the day, this election, particularly on the House side, it's just going to be a whole lot closer than people think.
Normally, the state of California does not move the dial on congressional races. That is because it's basically a single-party state with only 14 of 53 congressional districts held by Republicans. But this time, a number of those 14 seats are endangered due to retirements and heavy targeting by Democrats. Pete Peterson, dean of the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy, reviewed this situation with my colleague on 660 AM, The Answer in Dallas, Mark Davis.
It is a pleasure to welcome a gentleman that we've had before with an outfit we know well, the Pepperdine School of Public Policy. The dean of that school is Pete Peterson. It is great to have you back, Pete. How are you doing, sir?
Real well, Mark. Great to be with you.
So we're going to get to what your state there in California, and being a conservative in California is always an interesting adventure. I want to get to what role California might play in the midterms here in a second. But first up, let me give you, have you give us your 30,000-foot view of how the pendulum might be swinging. There were a lot of people who were kind of down in the dump saying, well, we're going to keep the Senate, but it really looks like we're going to lose the House. Now, that was, you know, that was so 3 months ago. Now, maybe not. What do you see happening?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. When you look, Mark, at the 30,000-foot indicators, Trump approval ratings, generic ballots, things have really tightened up in the last few weeks. I see the Senate, as you do right now, when you look at across the country at these races, Republicans, I think, are in firm control of 50 of these state races, with Democrats at 44. You have six or seven toss-ups there, and I think you're exactly right. If we have a big night, Republicans could gain considerably in the Senate. Even a medium night, Republicans hold. When you get to the House, you're looking closer to 30 to 35 toss-up races. So this last week here, certainly the races have tightened and come more in the way of the Republicans, but a lot to be determined here just in these last few days.
We take a look at when we look at the Senate, it's big states like the O'Rourke and Cruz race here in Texas, and not right. Every state is big, but it's every senator is a big deal. 435 House races, our attention can kind of get atomized out, but you gave a key number there, and that's with there are about 200 seats that are leaning Democrat or hardcore Democrat, about 200 seats that are leaning Republican or hardcore Republican. That leaves about right. 35 up for grabs. A lot of them are in California, which could scare me, but we should know that not all of California is a homogenous liberal enclave. So tell me what your state might mean on election night.
Yeah, that you're so right, Mark. I mean, the California is often seen as a blue state, but we use the phrase that state is really a fishhook. If you look at the state of California, starting in Orange County and then going down to San Diego and then really up through the Central Valley and up the eastern part of the state, it's a very red state. And in a lot of these districts, you know, there are going to be some races here that are going to determine whether the Republicans actually hold on to the entire House. Five races in particular in L.A. County, Orange County, and down through San Diego are really going to be determinative, I think, as to whether Republicans hold on to the House.
Yeah, I don't think anybody expects California to ever have more Republican members of Congress than Democrat members of Congress. But in these toss-up races, a couple of Republican wins, a few Republican wins in, like you say, Orange County and San Diego could spell the difference if it's a real nail-biter, you know, photo finish.
Our program is coming in today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up.
I think if you go look at President Xi's stated intentions, you can clearly see that China has a plan that is different than the one that they had 5 years ago.
Secretary Pompeo on increasing tension with China. When the Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. In Wednesday's Wall Street Journal, Michael Osland of the Hoover Institution penned an opinion piece entitled Backlash Builds Against Beijing. Although this statement surprises no one who's been paying close attention to foreign affairs, it's still not good news in light of China's growing international influence. One of the many U.S. concerns is China's growing internal surveillance initiative, coupled with increased repression of Christians and Muslims. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo recently visited China in an effort to, quote, de-escalate tensions. I spoke recently with Secretary Pompeo on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Mr. Secretary, in the past 2 weeks, I've had on Vice President Pence and National Security Advisor John Bolton, and now you. They both indicated a clear turning in our strategic posture vis-a-vis the People's Republic of China. And I wanted to ask, am I correct in recognizing our public tone is different? And was there a moment where the president said, look, I'm going to be the good cop with President Xi and you three and Secretary Mattis, you, Mike Pompeo, John Bolton, Vice President, you're going to be the bad cop. Did that happen at an NSC meeting?
No, Hugh, the truth of the matter is this has been consistent with the strategy that we've had since the beginning of this administration to recognize the competitive nature of the relationship between our two countries. And as China has taken actions that have provided risk to the American people, whether that's a risk through the stealing of intellectual property or trade rules that are unfair or activity in the South China Sea or their continued expansion in space and their efforts to develop their military, each of those actions has been met with a strong and vigorous response from the United States of America, and will continue to do so. There wasn't a moment, but rather an administration that has recognized the difference in China's behavior and the requirement for an American response to that changed behavior.
You know, Secretary Pompeo, you're West Point, man. Early this hour, I had West Point General Stanley McChrystal retired on. He talked about the treasure fleet of Zhonghe and how President Xi is now using that as a rhetorical device about Chinese expansionism across the globe. Do you think he's got any limit in mind, or is this a basically 21st century belongs to China strategy by President Xi?
I think if you go look at President Xi's stated intentions, you can clearly see that China has a plan that is different than the one that they had 5 years ago, or even 2 or 3 years ago. You see this in their ability to use their money around the world. And I've spoken to this. I spoke to it when I was in Panama, and I traveled the world. I remind countries, we welcome commercial competition with China on a fair and reciprocal basis. But when China shows up with bribes to senior leaders in countries in exchange for infrastructure projects that will harm the people of that nation, then this idea of a treasury-run empire build is something that I think would be bad for each of those countries and certainly presents risk to American interests, and we intend to oppose them at every turn.
Two more specific questions about China. You are a Secretary of State known for an emphasis on religious liberty around the world, not just at home. The United Nations panel estimates that the PRC currently have imprisoned as many as 1 million Uyghurs, but a Hong Kong-based human rights group put the number between 2 million and 3 million. The Chinese vehemently deny this. What is the Department of State's position on what these camps are all about?
These camps are clearly a Chinese effort to reduce the capacity for Chinese people to exercise their religious freedom. We've seen it in many different forms. We've seen it being more difficult for churches to put crosses on the roofs of their buildings. We've seen religious freedom practices be denied in ways that they had not been in years previously. These are real threats to religious freedom, something that President Trump has directed this administration to take seriously. And we're not only talking about this, where countries are denying religious freedom around the world, but beginning to use American efforts and global efforts to push back against these denials of the most basic human right. Indeed, an International Religious Freedom Day is upon us, and it's something the State Department will be talking about a great deal.
Birthright citizenship, the citizenship right of all persons born in the United States, has become a hot topic. That's because President Trump this past week announced that he intends to end this practice by executive order. In doing so, Trump got challenged from all sides, including House Speaker Paul Ryan, who dismissed an executive order as unconstitutional, a violation of the 14th Amendment. My Salem colleague Larry Elder spoke about this debate with another longtime colleague of mine, constitutional law professor John Eastman, former dean of the Fowler School of Law at Chapman University.
I want to talk to you first about the caravan, and then I want to talk to you about President Trump's assertion that he can change the interpretation of the 14th Amendment, which has been interpreted to allow an illegal alien to come to this country, have a child on American soil, and that child automatically becomes an American citizen. But first, let's talk about the caravan. Tell me what legal authority he has to put troops on the border.
Well, I mean, you know, the troops stopping an invasion in the United States is one of the primary reasons we have troops. Dating back to the Civil War, there's a federal law called the Posse Comitatus Act that says the U.S. military can't be used in the interior of the United States for regular police activity. But that's not what President Trump is proposing to do. He's proposing to put them on the border to stop folks from illegally invading our country.
Professor, how come previous presidents haven't done this? I mean, this so-called invasion, as you put it, has happened year after year after year. Not quite this large, but why haven't other presidents done this?
Well, because they don't like our immigration laws, and they're not willing to enforce them, and they don't think about the full consequences of what this lawlessness is doing to our society.
Let's turn to the 14th Amendment. Here is what President Trump said.
It was always told to me that you needed a constitutional amendment.
Right.
14th Amendment.
You don't. Number one, you don't need that. Number two,
I mean, that's in dispute.
You could definitely
that's very much in dispute.
Well, you can definitely do it with an act of Congress, but now they're saying I can do it just with an executive order. Now, how ridiculous. We're the only country in the world where a person comes in, has a baby, and the baby is essentially a citizen of the United States for 85 years with all of those benefits.
Professor Eastman, can he do this with an executive order?
Well, I believe he could. Let's just be real clear. First principles, the president cannot amend the Constitution by an executive order. Congress can't amend the Constitution by an act of Congress, and the Supreme Court isn't supposed to be able to amend the Constitution by issuing a judgment or a ruling in a case. But that's not what the president is talking about here. The Constitution doesn't require birthright citizenship. It says anybody born here and subject to the jurisdiction are citizens. All he's trying to do is clarify what that phrase subject to the jurisdiction means. And it doesn't mean anybody who happens to be subject to our laws because they're physically present here. It meant something much more complete than that, owing allegiance to the country, being part of the body politic. And that's what the debates on the 14th Amendment make clear. That's what the early Supreme Court decisions on this make clear. And the Supreme Court has never held otherwise. That would mean that the children of citizens or the children of lawful permanent residents are automatically citizens by virtue of the 14th Amendment. But the children of temporary visitors, whether it's a tourist visa or a student visa, or certainly the children of people who are not lawfully present in the United States at all, are not automatic citizens according to the Constitution. And the president is just trying to faithfully apply that clause as it was drafted and ratified and as it meant to the people that passed it.
I thought there was some sort of Supreme Court case that came out in the early 80s, had some sort of footnote which people point to argue that anybody who's in the country, even illegally, has a child on the American soil, is an automatic citizen. Isn't there some sort of case that people point to?
They do. It's a case called Plyler versus Dole, and it's the ridiculous case that said that states have to provide free education to the children of illegal immigrants under the Equal Protection Clause. And it cited a footnote that says, look, they're also citizens if they're born here. But that was not a holding of the case. It was not an issue in the case. It was just what we call dicta, that the Supreme Court just with the back of the hand added something.
Listen to the entire interview with Professor Eastman on townhallreview.com. I want to talk to you for a moment about a group I've done work with for years, ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. You've seen how your freedom is under attack, but if you act now, you can protect your family today and generations to come. Go to townhallreview.com to find out how you can join Alliance Defending Freedom to help ensure the opponents of freedom don't dictate your future. That's townhallreview.com. Coming up.
At first, we didn't know who was doing the shooting. So I immediately thought to myself, I wonder if this is a radical jihadist attack. I don't know what you could even do to stop it.
The Pittsburgh massacre hits close to home for Paul Kenger when the Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Pittsburgh is home to many people, Catholics especially, in Catholic institutions. Opus Dei, a ministry within Catholicism, has a center across the street from the Tree of Life Synagogue, site of the recent massacre. Two young daughters of Paul Kenger, prolific author and history professor at Grove City College, were entering the Opus Dei facilities when the shooting started. Professor Kenger shared his story with Michael Medved.
How is it that a devout Catholic like you gets implicated in this terrible shooting at the heart of Pittsburgh's Jewish community, Paul?
That's a good question, Michael. And actually, that does have something to do with it. My daughter, who's safe, you know, praise God. She and five other girls, all about the age of 16, you know, 16 to 14, 13, something like that. They were going to an Opus Dei center, and you know, Opus Dei is a kind of very popular lay group, lay order, lay ministry in the Catholic Church, and they meet just really pretty much right across the street from Tree of Life Synagogue. I've dropped them off there many Saturdays, usually about one Saturday a month, and it's ironic, Michael, the last time that we went by, we took a very close look at that synagogue, and I was reading it. There's Hebrew written on it. I can't read Hebrew, but also English, and they said, Dad, so what does that mean? I said, well, I don't know real well, but these folks are our friends. These are good allies.
Well, they are.
I never would have thought this would have happened.
And what's fascinating about this is that the evil killer, he came in at 9:45, which is right when services were supposed to start. And one of the characteristics particularly of Orthodox and conservative Judaism, is no one comes on time. The services are long, and people don't show up on time. They kind of wander in and then pray at their own speed and catch up. It's just the Torah reading that's really the center of the service, where everybody would hopefully be caught up or come before that starts.
And my daughters, they pulled up about 9:55. And you know, their thing was going to start at 10, and our friend Susie, family friend, the mother of one of the girls, was driving, and they pulled right across from the synagogue, right across the street, and she was going to drop them off. They were going to walk over to the house, and then Susie had this kind of gut feel that I should just maybe pull down the street a little bit more and walk them in today. So she pulled them over a little bit more, an extra minute or two, and at that point, cars started flying in, police cars. The cars returned sideways. They basically barricaded the road. And Susie said to I had two daughters there, and their friends. She said, "You girls, we better not get out. You better get down." So they locked the car doors, and they ducked below the windows. And we, about 10:16, my wife got a text from my daughter. It said, "Pray for us. I will call you later." And my wife said, "Oh, no, I'm calling now."
What a scary text to receive. Do you know what amazes me about this, Paul, is that it's very much fits in with, I've gone back and looked at every deadly attack on a Jewish target in the United States since 1977. Blessedly, there aren't that many of them.
And,
but most of the people who died in those attacks were Christian people who were caught in the crossfire, even the crossfire, because mostly no one was firing back. They were Christian people who were, in some cases, just wrongly targeted. There was a beautiful guy, very devout Christian and a son of a minister, who in April 13th, 2014, he was killed by an anti-Semite who was attacking the Jewish community center. He just brought his grandson there, and the grandson was killed, too, for a singing audition. They were doing a program at the Jewish community center.
Yeah. Well, and that's precisely what we were worried about, was them getting caught on the crossfire. Also, too, Michael, I immediately thought, because at first we didn't know who was doing the shooting, right? And so I thought, okay, what's the date? October 27, 2018. The day before, on Friday, in my Middle East politics class at Grove City College, we had just finished teaching the Yom Kippur War of 1973, which had ended, I think, almost 45 years ago that day on Saturday. So I immediately thought to myself, I wonder if this is a radical jihadist attack. Now, fortunately, it wasn't. Had nothing to do with that. But this was just some lone wacko. And the worst thing about something like this is, I don't know what you could even do to stop it. People listening, if you know somebody on Facebook or in social media who's posting vile, hateful things like this, and who's bragging about his weapons collection, and who's talking about maybe going down to the whatever synagogue to beat up some Jews, get on the phone and just call the police.
Our program is coming today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up.
One of the children that he formally adopted was an American Indian boy whose father had just been killed in battle. So Jackson took the baby and adopted him and raised him. I loved him profoundly.
Defending Andrew Jackson when the Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review, brought to you in partnership with ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Hugh Hewitt. It's hunting season within the left-dominated academy on historical figures, particularly white, male, political, or military figures. When we look at historical figures near the top of the list, it's Andrew Jackson, our nation's seventh president, and a figure whom a number of voices have compared to President Trump when it comes to style. Jackson served his country as an Army general, member of Congress, and two-term president during our nation's formative, frontier-driven years. Recently, demands have been made to remove Jackson's visage from the $20 bill. Here's my friend and colleague Dennis Prager with Hillsdale professor Bradley Berzer, author of a new release, In Defense of Andrew Jackson.
You may recall that people have wanted to remove Andrew Jackson from the $20 bill. He's probably the most controversial, though everybody now for the left is controversial who lived before them. The indictment of Andrew Jackson is, I think, largely over his treatment of American Indians. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think that's probably, at least since the late 1960s, that's been the great critique of the new left. And, of course, that's kind of seeped into all kinds of culture, and especially in the textbooks that our children are reading. So, yeah, that's where it came from. And it generally, and there are other things that people will argue about, but definitely the Indian problem is the main problem that comes up with him.
So what is your defense?
You know, there are a lot of things I think we could say about Jackson in terms of putting him into context. When it comes to the actual Indian removal, I think that his intentions were good, but the way that it played out was just horrible. Certainly, it would be very difficult to argue that the way that the Indians were removed from the southern states all the way to Oklahoma and into Kansas, that this was just in any way. It was pretty brutal. And I think if there's a fault with Jackson, it's more that once he set the process into place, he thought that it would play out well and didn't probably have as much oversight as he should have as president and as chief executive officer at that point.
By the way, he adopted either a black or an Indian child. Is that correct?
So he actually adopted a lot of kids. He was kind of the great patriarch of Nashville. But one of the children that he formally adopted was an American Indian boy whose father had just been killed in battle. And the mom was about to commit ritual suicide. And so Jackson took the baby and adopted him and raised him. I loved him profoundly.
I think it's important that people understand that racism may not have been a factor, because you don't tend to adopt those you think of are of an inferior race.
That's a very fair point. That's a very fair point. But Jackson has definitely become the boogeyman for almost, you know, he represents for so many people every single thing that was wrong in the early 19th century. He's kind of the ultimate Marxist, that at least their fear, the Marxian fear of a capitalist imperialist. And so, of course, they have to tie the racism in and other things as well.
So what is your take? What was his attitude? I mean, he routinely called them savages. Sometimes it was an appropriate label, and sometimes it was not. Did he, if you were to corner him in a room and say, do you believe that Indians are inherently inferior, what would he say?
Oh, he would absolutely deny that. And I think legitimately so. He did, like so many people of his time, there was an anthropological belief that everyone really from Jefferson on had. I mean, this went all the way up until, it was a debate for well over 100 years after Jefferson. It went up until probably 1900 or so. And the question was not whether Indians were racially inferior, but whether they were culturally not at the level that Americans were. So there was an anthropological belief that everybody went through these various stages of existence that went from essentially hunting and gathering to individual farm, yeoman farm ownership, to kind of corporate, later you would add on an industrial society. So at the time, Jackson was actually considered as a moderate on the issue of American Indians. Some people even really, really went after him for being, as they would have called it, an American Indian lover. And the reason was because as president, as he's really cutting costs and cutting the budget, which he did very effectively, he also was laying out tons of money for the removal of the Indians and for their resettlement in the West. There were a lot of people who thought, why is Jackson spending the money of white people so that red people could settle in these great areas on the Great Plains? It was really sought after land. So Jackson at the time, so different from today, and as you say, we have no moral nuances, or at least the left doesn't. At the time, it was a really complicated issue, and Jackson was very worried, without question. He was worried that the whites and blacks, who had a very, very high procreative birth rate, that they were just going to destroy the Indian culture simply by surrounding them and outpopulating them. So removal to the Western territories was a way to actually protect the Indian cultures, at least as he thought. Now, the execution of it was horrible, but his intention, I think, was generally a good one.
That's fascinating, and that's why the book is an important book. Now, you don't only defend him on the Indian issue. You have a general defense of Andrew Jackson.
You know, it's one of the things I found. So I think we all know that, and it's true, that Jackson was an incredibly violent man. There's just no way around that. In every way he was. But he also had really certain rules. So that violence never, ever could be applied to women or children. That was the same actually for blacks as well as for Indians and whites. He had a deep respect of women, a very deep respect, to the point, actually, he's almost worshipful at times. And he treats, again, Indian women as well as black women and white women very, very well. But the other thing I found about him, so he's got this violence, but he's got this ethic that's really interesting. But I also found Dennis, and, you know, counter so many current politicians, the guy was just unbelievably honest in everything he did. And, you know, I think it would have killed his soul to have done something that would have been misleading or dishonest. That's how much of a stickler he was about living out this deep, deep, profound honesty and his integrity. It's really quite stunning.
How did he get his bullet wound?
Oh, well, so he had a couple of, you know, he had quite a few because he was in a number of duels. But he had been a preteen and then a teen. As a 13-year-old, he had fought in the American Revolution along with his brother, and they had actually been captured. And Jackson, during imprisonment, had mouthed off to a British soldier who took the sword, the hilt of his sword, and actually beat in Jackson's skull, even until when Jackson died, an adult male could still lay a finger in that skull crease, and it wouldn't be actually even with the rest of the skull. That's how deep it was. And yeah, that's the kind of thing Jackson would never forget.
Is it fair to say, and totally differ with me if it isn't, he hated the British more than he hated Indians?
I don't think there's any question about that. This is, yeah, you just didn't cross Andrew Jackson. And because that soldier did that to him, Jackson
right.
never, ever
yeah,
forgave.
That's what I
that.
Thought.
I want to talk to you for a moment about a group I've done work with for years, ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. You've seen how your freedom is under attack, but if you act now, you can protect your family today and generations to come. Go to townhallreview.com to find out how you can join Alliance Defending Freedom to help ensure the opponents of freedom don't dictate your future. That's townhallreview.com. Coming up.
Let's just talk about prayer for a moment. I think that's the most valuable, powerful, useful tool in our whole toolkit. We can pray 24/7, anywhere, all the time. He's available.
Author Jen Caron. When the final segment of the Town Hall Review returns in a moment, stay with us. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Jen Caron may not be a familiar name to many, but among Christian women, and especially the readers among Christian women, she's universally loved. The author of over two dozen books, she writes mostly concerning the fictional village of Mitford, and in particular, Father Timothy Cavanaugh. On recommendation from Mrs. Hewitt, I read and thoroughly enjoyed Jen Caron's most recent book, Bathed in Prayer. Jen Caron and I recently spoke on the Hugh Hewitt Show. You know, my morning drive audience is full of people who love the news, but it's also full of people who've been reading your books for years. You know, usually women, people of faith. I actually asked the Fetching Mrs. Hewitt, my wife of 38 years, to write questions for me because she has read every word you've written. And her first question is, have you heard from readers whose hearts were softened or were open to Christianity as a result of reading the Mitford books?
Yes, thousands of letters have poured in over the years telling me the most wonderful stories. One quick story that always makes me smile. I was in two different cities on a book tour when two different young couples approached me, and they each said, I just love your books, or we love your books. They saved our marriage. Now, I don't know how to save a marriage. I couldn't even save mine. But you see, I do bathe my books in prayer. All of my work is bathed in prayer.
Yeah, you see what's going on in the country, how divided
yeah.
it is. Do you think
yeah.
of you're having a ministry of healing?
Well, I do. In fact, I think Mitford represents how amazingly simple it is to work across the aisle and help each other out. You know, when you're jammed into a small town with a small population, you better be helping each other out. And then when we're in a large continent with a large population, the same formula can be put to work. So I do think that Mitford is a microcosm of what could be a better world for all of us.
You know, one of the things my wife's put to me in her notes is that our culture does not normalize people who live a rich and faithful life like your Mitford townsfolk. Are you trying to encourage people to adopt that lifestyle? Because it is, it's completely different and it's wonderful.
Well, let's just talk about prayer for a moment. I think that's the most valuable, powerful, useful tool in our whole toolkit. We can pray 24/7, anywhere, all the time. He's available. God is available to us. And we just sort of dismiss this enormous, profound, loving power in our lives. You know, honestly, Hugh, I shouldn't probably say this, but I'm going to do it. I'm not against praying for a parking place. God is the Father. And we're his children. And he wants us to be better than we are all the time. He designed us in a certain wonderful, marvelous way. If we could only know how each one of us is designed for something better, we can keep coming up higher. And prayer is the powerful way to grow.
Thanks for joining us for this edition of Town Hall Review. Catch the entire conversation with Jan Caron at townhallreview.com. While you're at our site, sign up for our podcast, get a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin, producers Charlie Richards, David Posian, Michael Cook, Adam Ramsey, and Generalissimo Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks again to our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. And hear me out. Don't sit on the sidelines for this election. Please, please, please get out there and vote.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.